You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. These are not, to say the least, the very best times for conservation, for wildlife, for elephants and gorillas and lions and countless other species that are threatened by our species. So I was really happy to be introduced to the book, A Wild Life, a visual biography of photographer Michael Nichols by Melissa Harris and published by Aperture Books. It's kind of an unusual thing. It's a biography of a living photographer, and it's an interweaving of his images of wildlife, wild places, and his life story, which is beautifully written by author Melissa Harris, who has worked with Aperture Books and Aperture Magazine in New York for many, many years. Nichols grew up in a poor family in Alabama and became an award-winning photographer for National Geographic and other publications, and his work has been recognized both as great photojournalism and as fine art. He's gone to locations so remote or dangerous or just plain uncomfortable that most of us will never see them. And when he's there, he uses his extraordinary combination of artistic talent, ambition, and patience. It turns out patience is a major plus for wildlife photographers, to take pictures that make real change, changes in laws and policies, establishing wildlife parks, even engaging in dialogue with scientists. I had the opportunity to talk with Mike Nichols, who goes by Nick. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you've been doing photography for over four decades, and you were always drawn from the beginning to wildness and adventure. You set out, to, as it says in the book, to be the Mick Jagger of photography. Tell us about how you came to photograph gorillas in Africa.
Gorillas are what really changed my life. And growing up, my parents were divorced early, and my dad was remarried to a woman who had a collection of National Geographic. So to escape what I was growing up with, I would look at pictures of Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall and the ladies who studied great apes. So that was embedded in me. And as I became a photographer, I just took any assignment that would come my way. I was called the Indiana Jones of photography. I was doing rafting expeditions and caving and all kinds of dangerous things. So Geo Magazine had an assignment called African Bush Pilots. The photographer that was assigned it was very seasoned, and he realized this is really a stupid assignment, and he pulled out days before. In fact, the writer was already in Egypt. And I have to make a long story long because it is long. But I go to Cairo, I meet the writer, he's got a driver and a secretary, and we're talking about on editorial budgets. He's lost all of his money in the casino at the Cairo Hilton. I've never been to Africa or anywhere close to it. And this project just goes disastrously. But I end up in Kenya with what we would call African bush pilots. But they've all got on uniforms with lapels, and they're flying out of a beautiful airport. And it's not what the fantasy was, you know, flying with guys in bush planes. And that's where I ended up. I ended up in the country that's now called DRC. It was the Zaire at the time and had a dictator named Mobutu. And I ended up flying with a mercenary. And that's what I ended up with. But to get there, I got on a missionary plane and flew from Kenya to Zaire. And when you do that, you fly over exactly the volcanoes where Diane Fossey studied mountain gorillas. And the pilot looked down and he said, "That's where the crazy American woman lives alone with gorillas." And I'm looking out the window and I see nine beautiful, fantastic volcanoes. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go there. So this disastrous assignment failed. But as soon as I got home, I did some research and saw the mountain gorillas were super endangered. Diane was still alive. She was at Cornell writing her book, Gorillas in the Mist. And I made a proposal to Geo Magazine to go with Tim Cahill to do these gorillas. And I had never seen wild animals at that time. But I had, you know, gone to zoos. I had all these fantasies. And kind of immediately, I just felt that this was right. And all the pictures that I made are still with me today. And the story that we did made a big difference in conservation. And it changed my approach to everything. I started realizing I don't have to just do entertainment in magazines. I can do substantive stories.
You've talked about the process of getting to know about animals and their place before you start photographing them. And that seems to be a process involving both science and a kind of intuitive process. What's that like? What was that like when you first photographed gorillas?
I guess I always felt like if you informed yourself, you might make better pictures. And I'm kind of a obsessive compulsive. Well, not kind of, I'm completely obsessive compulsive. So I always thought that I should know everything I could, even because I don't have training as a biologist. I'm very much an artist in my and free in the way I approach things. But I felt like the more that I know, the better I can make pictures. So with gorillas, I read everything that National Geographic had published. I read everything that I could find. What's funny, that puts things in your mind that you start dreaming might be photographs, and they don't really happen, but some way you're better prepared for what really does happen. And I developed that throughout my career to the point where when I got to lions, I had spent 5 years talking about the project and studying and actually talking to the scientists that worked with lions so long. And there I saw where it really paid off because it gave me a edge as far as what I thought was going to happen.
There's so many large animals that are hunted. They're afraid of people for good reasons because people hunt them. How do you go about photographing frightened animals or animals? I mean, they're not frightened all day long, but they're frightened when humans come near them.
I quickly did get into a body of work when I worked in Congo for 15 years. I worked in Congo and Gabon with a man named Mike Fay for 15 years. There's something called habituated with animals. And when they're habituated, that means Jane Goodall or someone, Diane Fossey, has shown herself to those animals almost every day. And they, if they did have fear, they lose it. But they only lose it for the individual that's visiting them. So they may still retain fear of other humans. But when I went to Congo and Gabon, nothing was habituated. Everything was hunted. Everything was frightened. And in those cases, you can never show yourself. You're having to photograph, like sometimes I would sit in a tree, what we call a hide, and it's literally that's what it is, you're hiding. And gorillas have such great eyesight. Sometimes I would be 100 yards away and I'd look through a spotting scope and I would feel like the gorilla was looking me right in the eye. So they knew I was there, but they were like, okay, he's been there every day for a long time and he doesn't come out of the tree. We're still going to come and eat these vegetables. But that's what I started developing a technique called camera traps, which there's no trap to it. I put a camera in a place that I know the elephant might walk or the leopard might walk. When they break an invisible beam, it takes a photograph. And maybe my lights would flash, but they don't. It's not like a light comes on. It's like a lightning bolt. And animals that think of that as literally that, lightning. So they're not particularly bothered by that. And when I was in those environments, and this was 15 years, I had to use every trick that I could dream up to be able to get images into my camera. It became kind of my signature. I mean, the pictures were blurry. They were dark. They were energetic. And it wasn't necessarily just choice for that. It was the only way that I could make the photographs.
Do you think it takes a certain kind of personality to engage in that process of habituating an animal and have the patience to, you know, sit in a tree?
It does. It's historically, I don't want to go too far with this idea, but the reason Louis Leakey chose Jane Goodall to study chimpanzees for evolutionary purposes, and he chose the 6-foot-tall Diane Fossey to study gorillas, and he actually chose Birute galticus to study orangutans. And it was very conscious to choose three women to do long-term studies that were going to require this siege of habituation. You're going to fall in love with the animals and then bad things are going to happen. Mr. Leakey didn't think men could do that kind of study. And I don't disagree. Mike Fay, who's one of the greatest scientists I know, he can't sit still for 5 minutes. I mean, when I sat in the tree for 19 days he sat with me for about an hour and then was bored to death and he moved on. So I, in my case, I'm very, very patient because the work required that. I don't know if I'm so patient as an individual, but when it came to my work, I didn't want to be forcing it. I didn't want to be manipulating it. And when I saw that time is what the golden measure of what I did was about time, that's why I had to work for National Geographic. I wanted to work for National Geographic, but I had to work for someone that would let me spend a year on a project rather than a couple of weeks.
Yeah. It seems like, and again, it's such a fascinating book to read, this book, A Wild Life. It seems like there's a kind of line you have to walk. On the one hand, you get the animals used to your presence in order to photograph them. On the other hand, you want to respect their wildness and not do anything that's going to interfere with their lives. What kinds of decisions, like ethical decisions, have you bumped up against?
You don't interact. The trick is to not try to satisfy your own emotional desires. Because I'm telling you, when a baby gorilla wants to get in your lap, to turn that gorilla down is just super hard because it's just the cutest thing you've ever seen. But we know from the gorillas that Diane Fossey studied and the chimpanzees that Jane studied that it's not good for them to be comfortable. It's certainly not good for them to touch us. It's better that they think we're okay so they don't have to run away, but we're not there to be interacted with. It's easy to see that with an ape, which is so close to us, but the same would go for lions or elephants. So whenever I would spend a lot of time with elephants that were calm with humans, I didn't do anything to attract attention to myself. We wore the same clothing every day. We drove the same car. And what we would do is, for instance, my guide, who really knew these elephants, would say, I think they want to come under that shade tree over there to rest. So we would go to the shade tree first and park and just let them come to us. And so by the time they get to you, they've made the decision, well, that thing that comes every day is under our shade tree. Well, we're going to go anyway. And then with lions, same thing. I would go either before dawn or in the afternoon, and I would find them, and I would just park and say, okay, we're here. And you're basically announcing your presence again. And then they do their thing. But I never would, like when you see tourists looking at cheetahs in Africa, for instance, they're going to be bored within 5 minutes and somebody's going to be talking to the animal or shaking keys at it, trying to get it to perform. And what I always wanted to be able to say, if you would just wait, you will see things you could never believe. But that takes patience. So what it is, I'm trying to be an observer without influencing.
It's funny that Jane Goodall would say one shouldn't interact with them. I mean, all of those photographs of Jane Goodall, I mean, being groomed by, you know, a chimpanzee. I mean, she was so close to them.
Well, that's why we have to look at history. Before Jane did chimpanzees, we had no idea what wild chimpanzees even did. And when she goes there on Lake Tanganyika as a young woman, barefoot, and her mom goes with her, for the first year, all she does is walk and walk and look and look. And she can't make any progress. Now, here's the secret to what happened with Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey. They depended on National Geographic for their grant money. National Geographic wanted to make television shows about these fabulous women that were alone in the forest with the gorillas and the chimps. They wanted this interaction. And Jane would, I don't know if she would, let's ask her someday. If she had it to do over again, she would not have gotten so close. But that was part of the world we were bringing. Remember, we're talking about the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s. Well, what we found out was the children of those apes got too habituated and they got dangerous as they grew up. I mean, when Diane Fossey turned me down to come work with her, she said in a cable, do not, you know, you're emphatically denied to come. And then she sent me another note that said, don't add your name to Comic Book Conservation, just don't come here. And I had seen the picture of her in National Geographic that was published that year, 1980. the gorilla is sitting in her lap, and it has a lifesaver in its on its tongue. So not only was she playing with them, she was giving them candy. Well, that's terrible science, but don't let anybody interpret what I'm saying as criticism of those two pioneers. We learned, and now we don't do that. Now, if you go to a mountain gorilla, you're not supposed to get closer than 15 feet. You're supposed to wear a respiratory mask so that you can't give them human diseases. And if you shake a leaf at a baby gorilla, that's enough to scare it away. But chimpanzees are just incredibly like us. So they're outgoing, where gorillas are introverted, and they're going to end up using you as a display item, because chimps are all about warfare and politics and the same way we are. Whereas gorillas have a king and they take care of everybody. So you just can't have that kind of impact. So we're not criticizing Diane and Jane or Brute. That's the way they did it because they were pioneers. But no one today that studies these animals, even the women or the men that worship those pioneers, would never touch or interact.
Now, Jane Goodall took you to a place where the chimpanzees were what's called naive. They hadn't been hunted. They weren't scared. What was that like? What were they like?
Well, I'll correct you. We took Jane there.
Oh, okay.
And it's really cool because Jane, being a focused scientist, had only seen chimpanzees in the wild at her study site in Gombe, Tanzania. She hadn't even seen the chimpanzees down the lake at Mahale Mountain, who use a different kind of tool use. They have a different kind of grooming. What we found out once Jane had made the study of chimpanzees something that everybody wanted to do, and there became many other studies, some by the Japanese, some by the Swiss, they found out chimpanzees have culture, and they have different cultures for different places that they are in Africa, and they have slightly different genetics that makes them different subspecies. So when I started working with Mike Fay, and it was really originally as photographing lowland gorillas, but because it was a 15-year cycle, early in that cycle, Mike found a part of northern Congo that had so many swamps around it that the native hunters, the pygmies, the Babinjale pygmies, and or the French poachers, the men that wanted to hunt animals, it was too far for them to go and too difficult. So when Mike went into that forest, it's called the Ndoki, and crossed the three swamps, which are scary because of the psychology of crossing swamps in sandals, the chimpanzees inside that swamp acted as if they had never seen a human being before. And everywhere else in Africa, especially in Western and Central Africa, if chimpanzees have any a hint of a human being around, they will run for hours because they know that they don't know what a shotgun is, but they know that their family members die from large noises that come from these humans or these things that have two legs. And the way we would do this, we would go, and if we heard the chimpanzees, Mike would sit down on the ground and make the call. And I'll try to do something similar to it here. It's the call of a little deer, which is the size of a small dog called a duiker. And when they give birth, they bleat. They go, meow, meow, meow. And that sound, the chimpanzees know, wait, a duiker's giving birth. It's a free meal. And so they come rushing in as predators, as hunters. And there sit three humans with legs. It was like a close encounter of the third kind, where they obviously, what are you? And they're going, whoo. They start out with very excited noises, but then it shifts down to whoo, whoo, whoo. And they're literally right in the trees above you. This is mostly males. And if it went long enough, they would tell the females with babies, you got to come see this. And literally hours could go by. I would photograph as long as I could. The bugs were all over us. We're covered. Because when you stop in that environment and you've been sweating, everything wants the salt that's on your body. So all these stingless sweat bees come and cover you. The chimps, though, would be right above us. We've just encountered an animal that comes to us the moment that we ask it to come. And it took Jane Goodall years to get the chimpanzees to do that with her and to trust her. Now, what's interesting about this equation is we do these naive encounters, we announce it to the world, and we're, of course, immediately criticized. Well, if they're so naive and they're so special, why are you even visiting them? Well, Mike and I both knew that they were going to cut that forest as soon as they could find the technology to cut it. So we just happened to get there first. And rarely does that happen in conservation, where you get to a place ahead of the people that want to exploit it. So we started trying to make it into a national park from 1992 until we brought in the secret weapon in the 2000s. We brought in Jane Goodall to show her those naive chimps. And that was the press and the media that pushed that president to sign the document that would allow that part of the forest to be annexed into. We'd already made the national park, but we didn't get the thing that we were after to start with, because it's full of mahogany and valuable woods that they wanted to exploit. And today, it's still there. It's still protected. It's one of our most successful things, and the publicity that we did is absolutely what stopped the logging trucks. Once you annexed that and made it into a park, they weren't going to cut those trees. And none of those chimps to this day have probably ever had a shotgun pointed at them, because we saw what was going to happen, and enough young people were following us. One of the young men that came out early on to work as a volunteer is still there with his wife. He has a PhD from Cambridge. And so it's a miracle that this happened, where those chimpanzee families could literally live their whole lives and die without ever having a negative encounter with Homo sapiens. And we just like to mess things up. We don't really go for peaceful encounters. We like to kill things.
Well, kill things and also take them into captivity. I mean, some of the work that you've done is photographing chimps that have been taken to be entertainment animals or pets, or, I mean, there's heartbreaking photographs of, you know, a chimp tied to a chain in a garage. Incredibly heartbreaking stuff. You've taken pictures, others have as well, of wild animals in captivity like this. Has it helped to reduce the amount of that kind of kill and capture? Well, what they do is they kill their parents and then they take the babies.
Yes. It's basically a hunter. I think the hunter goes out for meat and he brings back something to sell. So he's brought back the mother dead and he's got the baby to sell in the market. And the baby might end up as a pet for a little while. It might end up in biomedical research. It might end up in entertainment in the United States. It might end up in the U.S. space program. When I did the project with Jane, we called it Brutal Kinship, because the whole point was to say, look, this is our closest relative in the animal kingdom, but yet we feel compelled to do these bizarre things. That's where photography is so powerful, and Jane completely understands that you can change the way people feel. One of my photographs is of three little babies in a wheelbarrow being pushed by a woman in a white coat.
Yeah.
And the wheelbarrow has a red cross on it. And most people, when they see that photograph, if I'm in an auditorium speaking, they laugh because it looks funny. And then I tell them what's happening, that those babies are in hepatitis research, and then the room quiets. But we used chimpanzees particularly as surrogates for funny commercials and weird things. But we also used them in science for language studies. We had a whole series of studies with sign language and syntax and things like that. And what's so interesting about that, we're not studying an adult chimpanzee that has a formed mind. We're studying a baby that's been torn away from its mother, maybe, or anyway, it's certainly a baby. What I saw with wild chimpanzees in many cases was a form of using their brain that goes so far from any of these silly language studies, where we get so excited if they can put three words together. Remember, this is three words in English. It's as far from a chimpanzee language as you can get. But the chimpanzees that I saw in the forest could find fruit and they could map the forest. They knew where all the fruit trees were, so they had mapping. They could use complex tools, not just one tool. They might use three different tools to crack a nut that's really hard. Anyway, the ability that they have in their brain is very close to ours, but we measure only from our standards. We measure an elephant's brain from our standards. And I've seen elephants, and elephants have a huge brain. You know this thing about elephants and memory? Well, an animal that has to drink gallons and gallons of water a day better know where there's water. So they have actually a weather station in their head. They have this incredible memory because they might need to remember 20 years of drought to know where's the water at when every other water is dried up. And we just never evaluate animals based on how they use the environment, which is exactly how we evaluate ourselves. We evaluate ourselves on how we function, not on how we go and speak Russian if we're from Alabama.
Right. Are scientists doing what you're saying they should do?
Well, we're getting better. We're talking about 40 years of work. So I think some of this silly stuff is passing, because a lot of those guys in the language studies, they did get criticized because they had the two-year-old. They studied it for their two-year grant program. And then where does that chimpanzee end up? It ends up either in biomedical research or in a zoo or in a horrible situation. And that's what Jane and I really did with Brutal Kinship. Besides making a very emotional appeal, we gave every copy of that book to U.S. senators and congressmen, and they voted on a bill that protected these apes that had served us in the space program or in biomedical so that they could have retirement homes. They're never going back to the wild. Most animals, if they've been taken from the wild, especially the kind of animals that I photographed, can never go back. They would be dangerous to humans if they went back to the wild, so humans might be around their habitat. But other chimpanzees that are there are going to kill them, because chimpanzees, that's what they do. So this born free concept is just a bunch of baloney, unfortunately. It's very romantic. And that's one of the things that a wildlife is really all about. If you take in the whole book and my whole body of work, you're going to come away with maybe a different feeling about wildness and nature. And what I innately kind of learned, because I was such a hardcore observer, is that all these animals really need is land and to be left alone. And then they can be wild. And wild is a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's so interesting. But tame is not very interesting. And tame and broken is even more or less interesting. And I'm not against zoos, because they provide an incredible service. And the animals that we have in zoos have been there, and they're not going out in the wild necessarily to get them. So if we were going to get rid of zoos, we'd have to kill all these animals. So we do have an urban population of animals. You'd have urban gorillas and urban elephants and so on. And that's what populates our zoos. But that's not an elephant. I mean, it could become an elephant again, I believe. And so could a tiger. It could become a tiger again. But there's a lot of danger between getting there. So I just hope someday our species can learn to respect something other than our own needs. And we're at a crisis time with that right now, where we've got this moment where we're going to say that, let's go back to just exploitation. Let's go back to everything we do should be about economics. Everything we should do is about jobs. Look, Jane and I also saw that you can extract oil cheaper in an environmentally sound manner than you can do by being sloppy about it. You can cut down a forest and maintain that forest where it'll grow forever. Just don't take it all at once. If you take 10% of a forest and you just take out the weaker trees when you're doing it, you've got something that'll keep feeding you forever. But when you have greed and you're only looking at a lifetime, a human lifetime, you can destroy everything in a few years. A couple of the trees that I photographed, one's 3,200 years old and one 1,500 years old. And that boggles the mind to think of that kind of time, because we think in this only in our own lifetimes. We can't even think, you know, past our grandparents. And when you think of a 3,200-year-old tree, that means that tree was around well before Christ and all of the stuff that we know about. And that tree's lived through lightning strikes and fires and all these incredible things that have happened in California in those 3,200 years. We have to start thinking in the long game. And the long game is millennial. It's not 50 years. It's not 10 years. It's can our children have anything left and their children and so on. You know, we people like me get criticized for being environmentalists or tree huggers. And I'm sorry. This is good economics. It is good for everybody to take care of the nest.
I think your book is, there's a lot to reflect on for the reader, because when you think about zoos, for example, and these tigers that aren't really tigers because they're sitting in a tiny space and they're given their food. They don't have the ability to hunt and to roam. Elephants that aren't really elephants.
If you're a predator and you can't get your own food, you have no life whatsoever.
Exactly. And then you think about, I mean, I found myself reflecting on what it is to be human. I mean, you put me and my friends out in the woods for 2 weeks, we're screwed. You know, we're tame, we're domesticated people, and we're reliant on the exact extractive industries and, you know, kind of greed-based economic system that is doing in the wildlife that you're photographing. And I think you talk about brutal kinship, you talk about kinship. I mean, you have had all your life a kind of attraction to wildlands and spending time in trees and in remote areas, and you seem to be able to weather the sweat beads on your body and getting sick and getting tired and all the hazards of being out in the wild. But there is something for the rest of us in really becoming maybe a little bit more wild ourselves. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's a reason the Central Park is there. Imagine what New York City would be like without Central Park. It would be uninhabitable. And so I believe that we absolutely need nature in our beings, and it calms us and it makes us feel something right. So we may have left it a long time ago, but it's in us. I just completely believe that it's not us against them. It's all for us. We're stewards of this planet because we're the top dog, and we have a moral right to take care of it. And that, to me, that's not a being so touchy-feely as it's often described. Hunters generally put a lot of money into conservation. It's not something that I need to do. But I've encountered plenty of people out west. Hunting is in their being, and they're not safari hunting. There's something that they feel is okay about it. And I would not argue that. A man in Montana has got to kill his elk and eat it. I don't have any problem with that. What I'm talking about is make sure they have the land that they can live on. Make sure we tithe 10, 15, 20% of the land that's on the planet to stay, not necessarily wild, but to stay without concrete on it. We can do this. We can absolutely do this. And to pretend like it's a battle is wrong, I believe. I don't agree with this. It's either or. I think it's just laziness, and it's about greed and instant gratification.
There are so many threats to wild animals, you know, not chimps and gorillas, lions and tigers, elephants. And it's not only poaching, and we haven't even talked about poaching for the ivory trade. There's also poaching for Chinese medicine, which is crazy, for bush meat. Then there's the loss of habitat for logging and mining, extractive industries. And then you have this reality that people, villagers, people of the land are trying to make a living farming, raising animals, which can be incompatible with wildlife. Take us through some of these places where you've worked and photographed, and tell us what's going on and how conservation is or isn't engaging the people who are living there.
Okay, I'll use three or four examples, and I'll try to be succinct. But let's start out with the mountain gorillas who live in Rwanda, the highest density rural population on Earth. And it's volcanic soil, and they can grow enough potatoes and beans in a spot almost the size of your closet to feed the family. It's really cool because the soil is so rich. What happened there is they saw that the gorillas brought more income to Rwanda than anything else, by far the highest earner of foreign exchange, because the Tutsis, after the genocide, the Tutsis came home. They're very educated. They've made it the IT capital of Africa. So Rwanda has come a long way since the genocide. But let's go back to the area where the gorillas live, right there on the border of Uganda, Rwanda, and Democratic Republic of Congo. Highest population rural on Earth. And the gorillas do not impact the local farmers. They come out and eat stuff every now and then. But by and large, they stay in their bamboo forests and they eat their vegetables that are growing in the area that they live in. So in that case, it's not a conflict. But then you get to elephants. And wherever there are elephants in populated Africa, the elephants have almost no chance. And what we really should be focusing on with elephants is how do we keep them out of a farmer's, they call it shambas. A man that grows in Africa, it's his shamba. And that's going to be what feeds his family and gets them through the living. But so what we have to do is keep the elephants out of their fields. But what happened in the last, since 2005, there's been an explosion in the ivory trade. So we got distracted from how we're going to deal with elephants clashing with humans to the fact that all of them are going to be killed for their tusk. But as soon as that gets solved, and right now the Chinese are saying they're going to stop it, we're going to have a huge problem. And you know what I think we're going to need to do? The wealthy world that wants elephants to walk around is going to have to build fences, big fences, because an elephant is not a little fence. It's a big fence. But you can do it. You know, I just think there's enough wealth. And all of us, I do believe we want elephants still to walk in the great parks of Africa. They're incredible creatures, but yet they're death to someone trying to grow crops. And then you've got lions in those same habitats. Lions are not really dangerous to people because we're not on the menu. But one of the things that happens in those shambas is pigs come out of the forest. They're called bush pigs to eat the crops. So all of that part of Africa, people guard their crops at night. They'll make a little platform. They'll have their lantern and they sleep in their shambas. And we've had an explosion of lions killing humans. Because the lion comes in to kill the pig and he runs into the human and he kills the human or maims him. And if lions ever get a taste for humans, it's a real problem because then they realize this is good food and it's easy to kill. So those of us in this conservation world, we want to have these animals. We have to mitigate these human-wildlife conflicts. And the same thing, another example that we might understand better is Yellowstone National Park. In the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which is the park is, say, 200,000 hectares, and the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is 2 million hectares. And that's huge, but that's what it takes for grizzly bears, wolves, mountain lions. And we don't want to have a grizzly bear in our yard. And they are very dangerous. It's not that they hate humans. A grizzly bear mom hates anything that's going to come near her cubs. They're just very, very protective of their cubs. And why is that? Because the male grizzly bear will kill the cubs. So she's just going to go berserk. In Yellowstone, we're not comfortable with wolves going out of the park because they say they might kill livestock. And they will. But did you know that if you're a rancher and you get on your horse twice a week and ride around your herd of cattle, the wolves are watching you. And they say, well, we're not going to kill those cattle because there's somebody guarding them. They call it range riding. And that's what they did in the Old West. They always protected their herds. Now, you know, the siege we had out in Oregon where all the disaster happened and all that. Mm-hmm. That's because we've let people graze their cattle in our national forest for $1 a year for like 100 years. And people believe it's their right. So they will put their cattle up at 10,000 feet in a meadow in the national forest and leave them there. And then they get upset if a grizzly bear kills one or a wolf kills them. And they say, And they have the right then to kill that bear or that wolf. And I just find that it's like, what? Okay, it's if the wolf comes down to your ranch and kills your cattle, fair game. You just have to make changes when you live on the edge of those places. And we met a family in Yellowstone, that longtime ranching family. They've started range riding. They're not losing any cattle. They lost 4 of their dogs. They used Great Pyrenees to guard their sheep and stuff like that. They lost 4 of those dogs to the wolves. They don't hate wolves. They say, we're educated. We know that these wolves should be here. We're glad they're back. We're going to learn how to live with them. It's not impossible to live with the wild is what I'm getting at, even in Africa or even in the United States, wherever you might live in the United States. Boulder had mountain lions coming down into Boulder, and they killed a couple of people. Well, the reason the mountain lions were coming down is Boulder was full of deer walking and grazing all over town. And the mountain lions like, I can't resist this. And after they had the 2 deaths, I think joggers were killed. They didn't kill the lions. They just started shooting them with rubber bullets. And nothing's happened in 10 years since.
So there really is, and I think a lot of people haven't really thought about this, but there really is kind of an analogy between like living with elephants in Africa and living with wildlife in the, you know, and living with like wolves.
Well, I left out the bison.
Prairie lands.
The bison is a great example. When we opened up the American West, there were millions of bison. We could be still feeding the world with bison if we hadn't. But we, a general, I'm not sure if it was Sherman or Sheridan, he basically stated to the president, if we want to control the Indian, all we have to do is kill all the bison, because that's their food source. And that's exactly what we did. We replaced bison, who really sturdy on the land. They can take the cold winters. They don't need antibiotics. They live perfectly off the grasses that are there. And we replaced all the bison with cattle that, you know, it's come from England or wherever they came from. And we destroyed this incredible food source to the point there were only 25 wild bison left, and they ended up in the high part of Yellowstone. And we're just trying to find out right now, can we live with these bison coming out of the park and going down into Paradise Valley? The bison doesn't want to freeze to death all winter. He wants to get to grass. Up in the park, he's got to plow his head through frozen snow to get to grass, whereas he can go down lower below the snow and do well. And we're just trying to get the ranchers to accept this. And it's very complicated. Bison have a disease that they got from cattle called brucellosis. Elk have the same disease, which they also got from cattle. But everybody wants to eat the elk and hunt it, but nobody wants the bison in their yard. But, you know, Ted Turner has made a fortune off of selling bison meat because it's very healthy for you. So, again, but I want the bison to be wild. I want it to migrate. I want it to be back in the plains. Why can't America be back to what it was 100 years ago out in the plains? There's nothing wrong with that. You're not, it's vast lands out there. You just got to make some measures and figure out how to do it. There's no incidence of brucellosis transferring from bison back to cattle, but the Montana Ranching Association is petrified of bison being on the landscape. I'm just saying, why can't we try?
Right, right. I've spent a lot of time with this book, and I've looked at your past books, and one of the things that is so striking to me is, I mean, there's a lot of talk about anthropomorphizing animals and making them seem more like us than they really are. And, you know, I mean, I think everybody has most people have the tendency to, you know, you see a tiger and you think about your cute fuzzy little cat, or you see an animal and you think about your puppy or whatever. Like right now I'm looking at one of the final pictures in the book, which is these lions lying down under the sun on some rocks, and for all the world I'm feeling them. You know, I feel like I know what they're doing. They're relaxing and having a nice time with each other on the rocks. And I think a lot of your photographs kind of give us the opportunity to feel our own kinship with these animals. Did you like feel that yourself when you were photographing them?
I think we've become so immersed. I mean, especially with lions, because I could find them every day because each one of them was in a scientific study. So one lion would have a collar that would send out a signal so I could find them. So we had incredible continuity. So every day we're in their lives and we know when they've eaten last and we know that, okay, they're really going to be hungry tonight. So you're living a lion's life, except that you're human and we go back to our tents and we eat our food and then we go back out. But my process was just about document everything I see. When I arrive, I'm active until I leave. I figure if I'm going to be with them, I'm going to be completely into it while I'm there. So certainly we felt like we were part of the team. You know, we could tell that the zebras were like, no, you guys are on that other team. And the wildebeest were like, no, we know you guys. You're with that bad team. And so we were lions, you know, in a benign box with wheels. But we traveled with them wherever they went. And we did a lot of nighttime follows using invisible light and night vision and thermal, except we're driving in a belching diesel noisy car. You know, I said when I finished that project, if I'd have just had an electric car, I would have been in heaven because it was the noise of the car that took us out of that magic.
Yeah.
You know, that made us be diesel and human. So in the picture you described, it says the same thing to me. And that moment was incredible because it just had a visit from the second male of the coalition that protects them. And it's been the first time he had tried to come to see cubs that maybe he sired or his partner sired, and they attacked him and they ran him off. He's behind me. So you see, I'm facing the lion sitting on the rock, sleeping on the rock. Well, he's all behind me about 100 yards, completely cut up and very upset about it. Cause this particular lion is the lover and the other guy's the fighter. And he just wanted to visit and say hi. And it was really incredible because one of the lionesses pranced over to him, really seductive, her tail. You know how cats are doing. And a couple of the cubs go prancing up. And I'm thinking, wow, this is really going well. And then the next thing, fur is flying. Oh, and they've all attacked him. And he didn't do anything because all he wanted was a free meal. The males are so conspicuous with the big mane. They're really not good hunters, but they can protect the female and the cubs from other males. But what you're asking, that's a product of intensity and editing. When you say that's the image I was looking for, and I shot 200,000 pictures on that lion project, and National Geographic published 13. Well, that 13 was the right 13, and I was part of that process, and we took out as much of the cute and fuzzy, but not all of it. You know, you're trying to tell a very legitimate story about wild lions. I've just been lucky enough and intense enough to translate what I've seen and give it to the world in a way that you could feel the way you do when you look at it. Right now I'm in this celebration of my career with this biography and we're all celebrating this concept of wild. And it's not journalism right now. It's art and it's essence. But for the 40 years before, it was about what I put in the pages of a very popular magazine that might affect change. Once you're empowered, once somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, this could make a difference, then you don't care about money. You don't care about everything else. You start thinking you have a higher cause.
One of the things that so struck me in this book was the phenomenon. I mean, you photographed tigers and it's amazing. There's a photograph of a tiger carrying her little cub in her mouth, like this tiny little thing. It's unbelievable. But there's this thing that happens, which is that a tiger will walk through the forest and all the different animals in their own different animal languages will say to their friends and compatriots, look out, there's the tiger. You know, as if it were like a chorus of different languages saying, cuidado, el tigre, whatever, you know, look out. Did you witness that?
Well, that was a lesson in Rudyard Kipling is what it was. It was a lesson in the Jungle Book. So you go to India, which is completely overwhelming for an American. And then you realize how could there be tigers in this incredibly populated place? India is the stronghold of wild tigers. They revere the tiger. And this book, The Jungle Book, which we know from Disney. And when you go to India, everyone talks about jungle. Even there, we think of jungle as African or Amazon forest. Well, the word jungle is a British word from colonialism of the Indian forest. And Indian forests are temperate forests. And all of those forests are ruled by Shere Khan. They're ruled by the character in the animated film. But it's, remember, it starts with a great writer writing a book called The Jungle Book. We all have that in our senses. We know that the animals talk in all those stories. Well, when you get there and you're being introduced by, I was introduced by mahouts. Mahouts, a man who can ride an elephant and use it to go into the forest. That's how I was going out to try to find tigers. And they're telling me, Nick, if there's a leopard walking, the monkeys have a certain sound they make when the leopard's walking. They also have a different sound when the bear in Jungle Book? There's a sloth bear, a kind of bear that lives in the Indian forest that is that bear, and they have a different noise they make when he's walking. And they have a very distinct noise when the tiger is walking. And I would sit there and I could hear this. And after so long, I could actually even distinguish that it was a different tone. And the birds have a call. The birds would talk. The birds would be the first one to alert the monkeys. And then the monkeys who had great eyesight, they would spot the, let's say it's a leopard. And I would be looking at exactly the spot where this leopard was sitting, and I could not see it. And the mahout would say, just keep looking. It will twitch. And what I would do is I'd find the monkey in the tree, watch him calling, and then look at his eyes. And I'd say, okay, his eyes are pointed down over there. So I'd look over there, I'd triangulate, and I'd stare at that spot. And sure enough, the tail would twitch or the spots would twitch. And for a moment, I could see the leopard staring right at me, and it would just take your breath away. So what would happen, because we did all this camera trapping with tigers, my assistant I would make him go to check the camera trap, and we would wait in the car sometimes, an open car by the road. And we would say, you know, you got to get back to us before tiger time, before the tiger starts walking. What was so amazing about it was the Jungle Book coming to life. And the Jungle Book wasn't as anthropomorphic as we thought. It was, they were making wild animal sounds that were language that said, the bear's walking, the wild dog is walking, the leopard is walking, the tiger is walking.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful, just the most beautiful thing. I'm the luckiest man in the world.
What is your hope for this book with respect to conservation? I mean, there's been some successes, but there's also a long way to go.
Let me go back to what Jane would say to me sometimes, because I was always after the big audience. I wanted millions of people to see things instead of a few. And we were in a bookstore signing Brutal Kinship, and there were about three people in there. And I'm like, why aren't we here? This is Jane Goodall. And Jane said, what if the person that comes in here changes the world, Nick? And I'm like, oh, okay, it's back to the individual. And that's what the chimps and her own mother taught her. And I want that book, if there's another Nick Nichols out there, or if there's another Jane Goodall, if they find this book, maybe they find it in the library, maybe their parents give it to them. It's a lesson that you can grow up poor, you can come from a broken home, you can have whatever kind of education, but you can have dreams, and you can live those dreams. And those dreams may not be with a camera. Maybe they're with a microscope. Maybe they're, you know. In other words, I want it to be an inspirational tale. When I thought about why would I be doing a biography, I'm just a photographer. But I know I've had a really interesting life, and I got there from a mother that had a fourth grade education, that was an alcoholic, that if she drank two times a year, those were two doozies. I mean, it would be hospitals and all of that. And my dad was a functional alcoholic, but he didn't live, you know, he left when I was three. And so I lived every dream I ever had. And the joke we started with was I wanted to be the Mick Jagger of photography. You know, Mick Jagger's the ultimate show off. Well, what I ended up doing was showing off my pictures. And I showed them to the world, and they established lots of national parks, lots of change in things, lots of fundraising. Those pictures have worked really, really hard. And they may be doing work 200 years from now. Then this book is all about summing all that up. You know, Melissa and I are both overjoyed that we did something together as a partnership that we believe is, again, far more than entertainment. It has a message.
Nick Nichols is a photographer, photojournalist. The new book is called A Wild Life, a visual biography of photographer Michael Nichols by Melissa Harris and published by Aperture Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was wonderful to be with you.
And if you want to find out more, you can go to the website michaelnicknichols.com. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.